Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, when we think of exploration, we think of unmanned exploration of the heavens and solar system. But my guest today reminds us there's still exploration on and beneath the Earth's surface. Hugh Lewis Jones is a historian of exploration. He was formerly the curator of the Scott Polar Research Institute and the National Maritime Museum in London. Today, he's an award-winning author of such books as The Crossing of Antarctica, The Conquest of Everest, and Across the Arctic Ocean, and travels the Arctic and Antarctic each year as a polar guide. For his latest project, he's teamed up with his wife, author Kari Herbert, and the daughter of polar explorer Wally Herbert, to put together a book about an explorer's most valuable possession, their sketchbook. Because science advances not through the exploration itself, but by the notes and observations of the explorer. Their new book, Explorer's Sketchbooks, writes about and reproduces samples of the sketchbooks of the famous, like Captain James Cook, Charles Darwin, Meriwether Lewis, or Ernest Shackleton, to explorers that are nearly forgotten today. It's a beautiful book, but it also offers an interesting look into the mindset of exploration. Hugh Lewis Jones joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Hugh Lewis Jones, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I know you've written a number of books on exploration. This book is a little special because it's designed to set out for people to take a glance at. But how did this idea for the Explorer's Sketchbook start?
Well, as you say, it's sort of a book of very many books. It's a book that begins with a whole bunch of unanswered questions. I'm a historian. I've made books in the past of great expeditions and great explorers, famous expeditions like the first ascent of Everest or Antarctica and the Arctic. But this particular book, Explorer Sketchbooks, was a chance to bring together a whole range of stories of some famous explorers, but a great more men and women whose stories hadn't really been told, a chance to gather together really rare, insightful, I think, objects and diaries and journals and give a glimpse of some of their activities and their adventures. It's impossible to fit all of their stories often into a single book, let alone a book that needs to contain so many stories. So it's a very visual book. It's a gathering. It's rather like an exhibition that we always dreamed of curating, but found it impossible to do so because these rare artifacts, these journals and sketchbooks, are scattered all around the world in private collections and family collections. So a book like this gives us a chance for just a moment to open them for a little while and let you dive inside.
How important was a sketchbook to what an explorer was doing?
Absolutely crucial. Explorers, you know, often died to protect them. They certainly, a journal within the covers of a sketchbook could contain all of the discoveries of a particular expedition. But what is exploration other than a process of stories to be told and shared? And whether it's 50 years ago or 500 years ago, many of these explorers and their successes depend entirely on the images and the information that they can bring back from the field. So more often than not, these journals are very important documents. They're, you know, sacred things for some explorers that allow them to journey for many decades after their time in the field. You know, a journal or a sketchbook for an explorer who goes on to write books or base a whole career on a single journey, that journal becomes a very important treasury of knowledge hard won in the field. And they also allow us, as the reader, to sort of eavesdrop on these moments of discovery, to journey with some of these great explorers all over the planet.
You actually, in your introduction, you allude to Captain Robert Scott. You know, that was the fateful expedition to find the South Pole along with the Amundsen, and of course, his party perished about 12 miles from the food that probably would have kept them alive and got them back to the coast. And when rescuers came in to find the party, the sketchbooks were what Scott deemed to be the most important, wasn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm not sure if many of your listeners, I hope they've heard of Captain Scott. These days, I suppose if you had to name one explorer, many would mention Shackleton, possibly the most famous polar explorer, I guess. But look, I'm looking at a picture of Captain Scott as we speak. I have a picture here in my writing room And in fact, it's a picture that's in the book. It's a very famous photograph of Scott. He's also writing. He sat on the edge of his bed, his bunk, I should say, in a hut in Antarctica. It's 1911. They've just emerged from a winter. He's about to start his sledging journeys toward the South Pole. He's holding his pipe in one hand, a pencil in the other, and the walls of his hut are fringed with books and woolen socks and gloves and pictures from home and mementos and little things like that. But it's a transporting picture. So Captain Scott was a writer. He knew that it was important to set his story down for the record, particularly so if he was unable to come home. And as you said, for someone like Scott, his journal becomes a very sacred object. In fact, it's the journal that really started me on my journey as a polar historian. It was Scott that I heard about, you know, sat on my grandfather's knee. It was Scott's journal, actually, that was one of the first that I sort of held in my hands and knew that here was an object that had lots of stories to tell. But the story of Scott is a simple one. He struggles to the South Pole. He is beaten, if you like, to the pole by Amundsen and a Norwegian team. And then he has 800 miles to sledge north back to safety. And he doesn't do it. And a blizzard confines him to his tent. His friends die around him. Eventually, the light goes out on his candle. And his letters and his journals survive him. And it's not for many months later that a search party digs his tent out from the snow, finds the bodies inside, and underneath his sleeping bag, a bundle of journals. And inside the journal, a note from Captain Scott, a message to his widow: please, can these journals be returned into her hands so she can hear my story? Can our lives not be in vain? And it's a sort of a day-by-day account, beautifully written, of men trying to do science at the edge of the map, but also not being able to come home to their loved ones. So many of these journals are filled with horrors and sorrow and hardship as much as joy and the beauty of new discoveries in places where none had gone before.
When we think of exploration of the Earth, we think of that as sort of a done deal for a lot of times. Are there still parts of the Earth that are not mapped, that are not explored?
Absolutely. Is there any exploration left? I should say, before we came on air, we had a chat, you and I, yeah. And you were telling me about the joys of Oklahoma, a place I've not yet visited, but I now know there are swamps in the south and grasslands and mountains, a place that I would love to visit and explore for the first time. But it's arguable that's not exploration. You were telling me about your brother, I think, Rich, who has a love for moths and setting up lights in the darkness to try and spot new species. Every day in our world, new species are discovered, whether on the seafloor, in the densest jungles, or at the fringes of known worlds. As we speak, NASA's Juno probe is orbiting Jupiter. Amazing to think, in just 100 years since Americans were racing toward the North Pole, this is 1909, 100 years later, you know, NASA are taking photographs of the North Poles of distant planets. So is there exploration still to be done? Of course there is. And so the joy of a book like this was to try and retrace the steps of some of these explorers in years past, to listen to the wisdom inside their sketchbooks, to try and take away some messages that might make us keep our minds curious and our eyes open.
What's really interesting to me is all the different things that go into making up a sketchbook. You might have somebody who's actually visiting, say, Africa, for example, and there might be detailed drawings. I'm looking at, this is William Birchall, who's doing these detailed drawings of rhinoceroses, but he's also doing really splendid artistic work of like their huts, of the people. Really, it's sort of a mix of all sorts of genres of science, from anthropology to zoology to botany. And in many ways, a lot of these explorers were generalists in a lot of ways.
Well, they were, and you mentioned this guy William Birchall. This is, you know, he's in Cape Town in South Africa in the 1810s. This is a time before science has its disciplines. So these explorers were true natural philosophers. You know, this is before geology and biology and anthropology and botany have their scientific sort of labels, but these are men going out and being interested in everything that they see for the first time, and things that are being seen and understood by new sciences for the very first time. So, you know, in the book there's a lovely little picture of him sat on his chair under the shade of an umbrella, sketching as he goes, or meeting with bushmen and noting down the notes of their indigenous music, or trekking through the bush to see elephants and rhinoceroses and all sorts of other creatures for the first time, riding along with his African wagon. This is sort of a rig that he get up for himself so he could sleep in the back of his cart and make maps and charts and draw as he went. Birchall is one of so many explorers in this book that I find quite incredible. And unlike Scott, I should say, who, you know, is writing his journal as he's dying in his tent, someone like Birchall has a more enjoyable time of it, I should say, you know. And so some of his sketches, you open his sketchbooks, and it's a bit like looking at a holiday album, and I mean that in the best possible way. So as you or I might go on a trip and snap pictures on a phone of a beautiful sunset or something that we like or something that captures our eye, Birchall as an artist was doing much the same. So these weren't images, you know, in death-defying moments. They're images caught in the happy times, when the sun is right for painting, when you've stopped after a long day on the trail as your hippo steak sizzles in the frying pan on your fire as you sit by a stream and you paint an image of what is in front of you. So for many of these explorers, you flick through their sketchbooks, and it is really like seeing what they're seeing. And they're wonderfully personal and private things. That's also the other treasure of being able to create a book like this, is having the chance to have a glimpse of some of these secrets that explorers carried within their journals that they perhaps had never intended to be seen. And now we have a chance to look at them and appreciate the wonders that lie inside.
Some of the most famous explorers that are featured in the book, Roald Amundsen and Charles Darwin. What's really interesting about it is, yes, in Amundsen's case, you have the page of his journal where he reaches the South Pole, but a lot of the entry is devoted to other types of other expeditions besides the one that made him famous. Or Darwin, you see this really amazing topographical sketch of the Chilean coastline, which, you know, we think of him working with animals and botany, not geography. Sort of gives us a different take on what these gentlemen were doing, wherever they were doing it.
Well, I hope so. I mean, again, you pick a famous name like Darwin or the Norwegian Roald Amundsen, or, I don't know, Lewis and Clark or Robert Peary, two other famous American explorers. But the challenge is to try and approach figures that amount has been written about, or stuff that we think we know lots about, and looking at other aspects of their lives and careers. And of course, many of these explorers, both men and women, had very long careers and perhaps are only now known, if known at all, for a few little things. But of course, you know, someone like Darwin, who, you know, is known for his work on evolution, of course that work comes from a lifetime of thinking and drawing and writing and observing the world. And so, you know, there's almost an infinite variety of things you could show or say about someone like Darwin. And that applies for everyone, really, in the book. And I think of wonderful lady travelers like Adela Breton and Amelia Edwards, Freya Stark and Gertrude Bell, Olivia Tong. These are names that probably your listeners have never heard before. And so I would urge them to dive into a book like this, and you can catch butterflies and explore, you know, ruined temples. You can ride through a desert with your journal, you know, tucked away in your bags with a pistol in your knickers. You can fight off bandits and climb mountains and, you know, have a really happy time of it. And you can do all of these things just by reading their letters and looking in their journals. And the one thing's for sure, I can tell you, after all of this sort of reading and writing and researching, is that I've come away with far more questions than I have answers. A book like this really is almost never-ending. The more books you read, the more you realize you have to read, if that makes any sense.
My guest today is Hugh Lewis Jones, a historian of exploration, author of a number of books, and his latest book, which he's co-written with his wife, Carrie Herbert, is Explorer's Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure. It's a beautiful book, which has reproductions of many of these famous explorers and a lot of not-so-famous explorers' sketchbooks, the things they thought were important as they were in the field visiting somewhere. And you said this raises more questions than it answers. What are some of the questions that come to you?
Well, the next question is, firstly, all of the people that we had to leave out. You know, a book like this, just sort of 300 pages long, covering 500 years of history from the bottom of the seafloor to the highest mountains, the edge of space. You know, clearly there are lots of stories that could have been told that we simply haven't had space for. I'm also glad you just mentioned the co-author of this book, Carrie Herbert. I'm very pleased to say is my wife. Carrie, her late father, my father-in-law, was an explorer himself, a guy called Sir Wally Herbert. Not really well known, I guess, in America, certainly quite well known here in England as the man who led the first expedition to cross the Arctic Ocean. But someone like Wally, who in this book we include a few of his sketchbooks from his time in Antarctica, not the Arctic. Certainly there are so many more questions that we could have answered about Wally's polar career and how he became an artist, what inspired him as an explorer, how he felt about his achievements in the field. All of those sort of questions that we've tried to answer parts of, you need more space and you need more time. And, you know, if there's still so much that's unanswered about someone that is a member of our family, think about all of the unanswered questions about people for whom the only things we have that survive are fragments of letters or glimpses of diaries or things that really are little known and not yet understood. Every time I talk to people about this book or approach writers and speak with them about other books, I'm pointed in the direction of another explorer or another journal or another archaeologist or botanist or jungle explorer or pioneer or entrepreneur or indigenous guide or any number of stories that really haven't been told and should be told. Another nice aspect of this book is the chance to meet real explorers. And you know, I've got a number of people in this book who are still with us and who are still traveling and exploring. I think of Wade Davis, an Amazonian botanist, or I guess most notable amongst all is a man called Alan Bean, who maybe some of your listeners know as being one of the moonwalkers, one of the Apollo astronauts, and a later...
That's right, the fourth man to walk on the moon.
Correct, another commander of the space station. Well, he was an artist too, of course, and so for Alan, you know, he almost kept sketchbooks in his mind. He couldn't sketch on the surface of the moon, too many rocks to collect. But coming back from the moon, you know, for 40 or 50 years, he's able to close his eyes and imagine and dream and remember, and has spent a whole sort of second career at his easel creating some really amazing paintings of his visions, his views of another world. You know, it could be argued he's the only man ever to have painted some direct experience of another world. So Alan is one of many explorers who answers some of the questions that I have and also raises far more questions. And so, you know, that's the joy of this kind of book, whether from the Amazon to the source of the Nile to the top of Everest to the edges of new worlds and distant planets. There are lots of ways that these things can be remembered and recorded.
It might be surprising to some. It really shouldn't be surprising how many women are featured as far as explorers. And you have all sorts of women that are exploring Suriname when it's still a colony, going to, say, 19th century Japan and really recording and beautiful, beautiful watercolors, what life was like at Japan. We have to remember Japan was closed to the West, and so it was an exploration to various places in Africa. And it's very surprising how many women were out recording their impressions, doing research in a time when science really did not accept women.
Yeah, I mean, this book is full of pioneers, and a lot of these the female travelers were pioneering in so many different ways, breaking through the barriers of their times and their class and the restrictions placed upon them. I mean, it's an A to Z of great travel, both male and female. I sort of jump midway and think of the M's in quick succession. You have Margaret Mee, who, you know, a British botanist who spends the best part of 25 years searching for a single moonflower that she hopes to capture in paint, and her pictures are in the book. Or Maria Sibylla Merian, a very early artist in the 18th century. Amazing, she spends her life drawing caterpillars and frogs and painting alligators and snakes and all sorts of things that are being brought back to her from the Dutch colonies. Or someone like Jan Morris, another M, who in a former life as James Morris was a journalist on the first Everest ascent and had a sex change sort of midway through her life and is now one of our greatest living writers. Jan Morris, a wonderful woman who is one of our greatest travel writers. So not perhaps an explorer as such, but certainly exploring countries and encountering peoples and writing something of her experiences within her journals. And so on and so forth. So some really incredible people. And, you know, my wife as co-writer really made sure that I did my best to include as many women as possible. And you know, certainly had we more space, I would have included a great number more.
Another one would be Alexandrine Tin, who was trying to be the first woman to cross the Sahara, which is really an amazing story. I want to ask about a 20th century person that you included. He was William Heaton Cooper. His exploration is a different sort of exploration. I like the broad way you view explorers, because he worked in the Lake District, which was, I'm sure, well explored by the midpoint of the 20th century. He made these amazing pictures of the Lake District, but he was sort of exploring on a micro level, not a macro level in ways, wasn't he?
Exactly, and you know, that's it's almost a perfect example for the sort of eclectic range of this. You know, he's in the book, William Heaton Cooper, a name that I'm pretty sure none of your listeners have heard of. Certainly in England, he's not that well known either. He's wedged in the book between Captain James Cook and someone like Charles Darwin, so two very famous names. But William Cooper was an artist in the British Lake District. He was a climber, in actual fact, so one of the sort of earliest climbers to also paint. And, you know, his meticulous journals and quite beautiful paintings detail a different kind of exploration. So, you know, he's plotting out new routes on rock faces, feeling with his hands, a very tactile kind of exploration. But he's also exploring in an artistic sense. On a personal level, I included him because, you know, I grew up on an island, but I longed to be a mountaineer, and I kind of got my first taste of adventure walking in the hills in the English Lake District, and climbed my first mountains and slept out in the wild in places that William Heaton Cooper also climbed and painted. So from my point of view, although I didn't really describe it in the book, that's why he made the cut. So all of the choices really in this book are very subjective, and, you know, by its nature, with a book that could have been so broad, you have to make your selections. And for me, his art history, as much as his exploration, deserves him in a place in a book like this. And many other explorers are like that. I would hope that for every famous name in this book, there's a name that someone has never heard of, and as a result, embarks on a kind of a new journey in reading or internet searching or whatever to try and find out more about them.
And I love the way you laid out the book, because you laid out all these explorers in alphabetical order. So as you turn each page, you're going to a vastly different part of the world. You're in a sense sort of exploring yourself as you go through the book.
Well, I hope so. I mean, on the one hand, it seems like the most obvious way to structure something, a simple A to Z. But I actually had to fight pretty hard with my publisher to make it so. It would have been more obvious, I guess, to sort of do a book that's Atlantic or regional, say all of the polar explorers in one corner and all of the sort of African explorers perhaps in another. But the more you read, it gets more complicated. Obviously, there were some explorers who traveled to lots of different regions, so where would you put them? But equally, by arranging it so arbitrarily as A to Z, I think it really allows for sort of an ebb and flow of wonderful contrast. So yes, on one page, your beautiful journals of parrots and from deep from the jungles, you flip a page and you're in Aztec ruins, you flip another page, you're back in Africa, you flip a page and then you zoom up to Tutankhamun's tomb, you turn the page and you're maybe with Cook in the Pacific, you turn the page and you're back in Egypt, you turn a page and you're crossing Antarctica. So it's sort of almost giddying and sort of a never-ending sort of a ramble. But at the same time, I love the contrast that it gives us and the range of scales and sort of the variety of the world in which we live. And it just really reminds me at every turn of the page what an incredible world we live in. And there's so much of it still that's out there for us to admire and enjoy.
One last question, Hugh Lewis-Jones. You saw all these different sketchbooks. Was there one in particular where it was sort of surprise and delight at the way this explorer arranged his sketchbook? Was there one that particularly stood out?
Oh, that's an impossible. That's like trying to ask a proud parent their favorite daughter or something. No, each sketchbook it pleased me in different ways, and that's why the 75 or so who have made the cut from, you know, an infinite array of explorers. But to give you one, other than obviously my father-in-law, Sir Wally Herbert, this polar explorer, there's a man called George Lowe. And very quickly, I have written a number of books for him. He was on the Everest first ascent in 1953, a New Zealander, the more famous, his best friend, Sir Ed Hillary. But George was a modest guy on that expedition, wrote letters home to the family all through the climb. But he later goes on the first crossing of Antarctica. This is in the 1950s, as the photographer. And so his journals are full of sketches, writings, but also images that he developed for himself in the middle of Antarctica.
Talking photographs.
Carrying his, you know, developing liquids in a thermos flask, in a dark room that he's built for himself. And these little fragments of photographic history are stuck in his journal and carried with him every step of that great journey. And so a book like that is a good example of how a sketchbook or a journal can transport us right into the heart of the action, right into the middle of a great adventure.
All right. Hugh Lewis-Jones, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, that's my absolute pleasure. Happy traveling, everyone.
Hugh Lewis-Jones is a historian of exploration. He and his wife, Kari Herbert, are the authors of Explorer's Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure. It's published by Chronicle Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.